Thanks for continuing on with us. This is Notepad. We're doing a special show called Pantau Kerajaan Baru or the Monitoring of the New Government. Yesterday, we had Dr. O. Ehsan. Today, we still have him largely because the conversation is very robust. We were talking about some of the policy matters, about what needs to be done, what is being done, and most importantly, how are they going to get it done. That was yesterday. Today, we shall look at the political dynamics and structure in terms of how it's going to be done. Dr. O, yesterday we touched a little bit in terms of what was the mechanism that is going to be put in place. But let's talk about the realities of things right now. Say, for instance, in Sabah, GRS and Warisan, they are on the opposite sides of the aisle in Sabah. But in federal, they are together. That's one element. Another element is it seems like GPS is not entirely all in with Anwar and Pakatan, but they are pulled together to work with this government at the behest of the king, because Yang di-Pertuan Agong says that we need to have a unity government. And then people keep on repeating the notion that why would Anwar want to work with these people and so on. But again, it was reminded countless times that this is not Anwar's cabinet, this is a unity cabinet, and he cannot appoint everybody, all his men to the cabinet because he did not have 112. He did not have the kind of support. All this boils down to the vote of confidence that's going to take place 1 week from now. What is the statement that you think is appropriate in terms of trying to paint a picture of how this government is going to perform? Will this government last, in fact?
Well, a lot of attention has been paid to the 19th of December, right, when Anwar would call for so-called vote of confidence. But frankly speaking, that is symbolic in nature. Let's say he survives that vote of confidence. He survives it at the moment the vote the votes were cast. But the very next day or even the very next hour, whether this government would still survive, I think that remains to be seen. Because even though we have this so-called anti-hopping laws or sets of constitutional amendments, but they have yet to be tested in court. For example, a particular MP, he or she may still belong to a certain party. Let's say he or she belongs to UMNO, but maybe he supports Tan Sri Muhyiddin as Prime Minister.
Yeah.
If UMNO were to sack him under our anti-hopping law, he could still take his seat with him and cross to the other side. Even if he doesn't cross, he still remains an UMNO MP. He could still profess his
allegiance
to Muhyiddin. So, and that is why sometimes this government may not be as stable as we would imagine, as Dato' Sri Anwar claimed that he has a two-third majority in parliament. At the time of the vote of confidence, yes, maybe, but afterwards we don't know. Yeah.
Because of this ever-changing dynamic at the political system, the political risk of the country is still assessed as high. We're not abating the political risk situation. This dissuades, I'm talking about theory, this dissuades international investors and domestic investors from doubling down on us. Do you feel that this situation is going to persist in the years to come?
Yes, judging from the electoral results of the last general election, there seems to be a divide between those who prefer a more conservative outlook for the country and those preferring a more progressive and reformist one. And they are almost, at 45-45, with a very small group of middle-of-the-road voters in the middle. So in that sense, I think this sort of rather ideological or philosophical debate would go on for some time, while, as I said, countries such as Vietnam would catch up and even surpass us. Yeah.
Talking about self-preservation and self-interest, Dr. James Chin of University of Tasmania argues that Sabah and Sarawak would not necessarily like a stable political system because this actually benefits them. They do act as a kingmaker. That whole political divide that you speak of, that's Menanjung. Generally speaking, Sabah and Sarawak, Sarawak clearly one block. Sabah might have some differentiation factor there. But generally speaking, Sabah and Sarawak now has a larger say. In fact, one Deputy Prime Minister is there. Yeah. Sabah and Sarawak are both in the unity cabinet. How do you see the lens from Sabah and Sarawak here?
Well, I think you need to distinguish two factors of which sort of describe the politicians in Sabah and Sarawak. Number one is they typically prefer to be in the state government as opposed to in the federal government. So you will see people like Shafi Abdal, for example. He's not in the federal cabinet. I think he's gunning for the Sabah chief ministership again. Mm. But whether he will succeed, that's another story. Mm. But the politicians in Sabah, for example, I think they are, most of them are sort of wondering whether there will be yet another change in the state government lineup, possibly still the same partners, but with a different chief minister, for example. The other distinguishing factor is, of course, a lot of politicians would indeed fight for MA63, the privileges and special positions of Sabah and Sarawak under the constitution and so on. That's very nice, but a majority of them, I think, would still think of their own vested interests in various projects and so on being paramount. So that's why you sometimes could not persuade these MPs on Sabah and Sarawak simply by promising certain reforms, MA63. You also need to, promise them certain projects, for example.
That's why Dr. Fadila is there, Deputy Prime Minister, in terms of trying to bring more developments in terms of Sabah and Sarawak, and seeing how he is clustered together with other ministries and functions in terms of trying to bring or close the urban-rural divide. That's one hand. Another hand is in terms of the politics behind it. GPS... was ready to work with Tan Sri Muhyiddin and the theological bloc that he represents. There were some uproar in terms of the Christian groups, for instance, inside Sarawak and other NGOs that were trying to argue against the amalgamation of GPS with Perikatan Nasional. And I don't know what change of heart, change of persuasion. The AP started issuing apologies, and now they are with them. It just highlights to me that GPS and some folks in Sabah, some factions in Sabah as well, they are, on one hand, might not necessarily be too comfortable working with Perikatan Nasional, but, it's not a ruling out faction here. I can work with them if the conditions are right.
Well, they worked with Perikatan over the last 2 years, right? They were part of the Perikatan government. I saw pictures of Abang Joe sitting next to Hadi Awang in the Perikatan meetings at the time. It looked rather cozy. So I don't think that's a problem. It's just that I think after the general election, I think the prevailing mood swung very quickly. Some sort of consensus that this country must still go ahead and have a progressive outlook. I think among the Malaysian elites, that sort of consensus came up quite quickly. And GPS and GRS, they sort of followed that trend. And that's why, Anwar got to form a so-called national unity government here.
On one hand, it's very disheartening to note that politicians are not working on principles and what they argue. On the other hand, it's, let's be pragmatic and realistic about things. People do work in the interest of themselves. And because of this, the stability of the government has to be continuously brought into faction. However, one would like to argue that Anwar is a larger-than-life political figure. He's been around for years, yonks even. And the idea here is that he is, if anybody can do it, it's him who can pull this off. Do you share this kind of sentiment?
I do. He must have a core team of ministers or advisors who could really work very closely with him, enjoying his complete trust. For example, his party deputy, Rafizi. I think people are still speculating. Are they really friends, father and son figures? Or is Anwar trying to still do something to prevent Rafizi from replacing him one day and so on? So you need to trust your own people yet. If Anwar could trust Rafizi as he trusts, let's say, Saifuddin Nasution, I think that would give Anwar sort of a core team of advisors and ministers. And then he could expand it out to include some other coalition partners. But he must have his core team in shape first. Yeah.
Let's do some pop psychology here. Mm-hmm. The previous notion is that he was never in power, and therefore he had to be very careful in terms of who he brings into the fold, mm-hmm. into his inner circle. Now that he's in power, do you think there will be some level of paranoia, some level of distrust, or in fact, because he has power, he can now trust more people?
Well, for those with vested interests in this country, the fact that UMNO is in the government is very comforting. Huh? It would not be Anwar and his reformist troop trying to tear down everything and rebuild everything. So for that group of vested interests, there's UMNO. On the other hand, of course, there are the Pakatan hardcore supporters, right? After more than a quarter century of waiting, they would, of course, like to, well, tear down the buildings and rebuild it. So
they're called reformers for a reason, right?
Yeah. So Anwar would have to, in a sense, reconcile between these two groups. We are not even mentioning the other side of the political divide, huh? All these more theologically inspired people and so on. We are just talking about, on Anwar's side, huh? He has this the more reformist-minded and the more status quo-minded people or interests.
It is so bizarre. Now that you've coloured the political dynamics as such, so we're looking at three broad colors, mm-hmm. yeah, the theological inspired group, the reformist inspired group, and the status quo or business mm-hmm. pro-business friendly yep. group. Yep. It seems like, for all intents and purposes, reformers and the pro-status quo groups can work together because they still think about the benefits of the economy.
Oh yeah, of course. It's just that how do we do business, right? The reformists would think, oh, everything has to be very clean-cut and systematic and so on. The so-called status quo group, they would think, oh, well, sometimes you need to grease the hands and under the table and so on. So, but still, the overall image is of Malaysia, which is progressive, forward-looking, be able to punch above its weight on the world stage and so on. The other side of the political divide, I don't know. I simply don't know what kind of social, economic, financial outlook they have in mind for a country such as ours.
Put it this way, Roto. Mm-hmm. As bizarre as it sounds, they are the biggest winners from the GE15. The electorate wants them, evidenced by the GE15 results. And just to further enunciate that point, Padang Serai was again won by PN. The public wants them. And clearly, the public has had enough with whatever folks that we have right now. They want new faces. I mean, the bastion of PKR, Pematang Power, was felled. Mm-hmm. Nurul Izzah lost there. Padang Seraya was being won 3-4 times already, but now won again. So it seems like for Padang Seraya, for instance, is not a complete wholesome Malay voters. There's a lot of non-Malay voters there, and yet they still can win by 16,000 majority. So why would Perikatan Nasional back down, knowing that the public support is behind them? This was exactly what was done by Pakatan Harapan, before that Pakatan Rakyat, in 2008. And, you know, 14 years down the road, they hold it power. Mm-hmm. Why would Perikatan Nasional back down now?
Well, they are not backing down. In fact, I think they are trying to be
more aggressive.
Be more aggressive in a sense. The attitude now, it's like UMNO. After the Johor and Malacca state elections, they won handsomely. UMNO was gunning for a general election as soon as possible. I think
blew
now
back in their face.
That's right. I think Perikatan Nasional now, they have a similar set of attitude. Namely, they would think that, well, number one, if they could somehow, flip a few MPs and make themselves in government, that's all very nice. If not, even if Anwar were to call for another general election, let's say in a few months' time, I think they are quite confident that they are going to win more than even what they won, a few weeks ago, and thereby form a federal government outright with a majority.
Okay, we'll go for one more short break. Mm-hmm. When we come back, we'll discuss the conclusion of our conversation with Dr. O. A. San of the Pacific Research Centre. We'll be right back after these messages. Thanks for staying on with us. This is Notepad. We have a new segment called the Pantau Kerajaan Baru, or the monitoring of the new government. Dr. Oh, the conversation needs to further progress. We need to talk about the people right now. I want to learn more about what you think about the perception of rakyat Malaysia, both in Semenanjung as well as in Sabah Sarawak, urban folks and rural folks. It's very strange. You see workers in KL, for instance, they go back to their hometown, they vote for Perikatan Nasional, then they come back to work in a PH-controlled state. Sabah Sarawak, turnout was rather high, if you ask me, for the benchmark that has been set by Sabah and Sarawak. And institutional integrity has to be there. Redelineation is up for grabs right now. Anwar has a two-third majority. Can redelineation take place? What are the broad strokes that you want to share when it comes to people right now? Undi 18 was a very strange surprise. People thought that they would vote for Pakatan Harapan. That did not materialise. They voted handsomely for Perikatan Nasional as well.
Well, we always thought of young people as being reformist and progressive, right? But of course, it's only a small group of young people who are as such. A larger group apparently would be more conservative in their outlook. I think due to the various excesses of this country over the last half century and more, a lot of people are perhaps looking forward to a more, shall we say, puritanical or simpler way of life. And in a sense, Perikatan subtly hinted that, well, voting for us, that's one possibility. You have a cleaner life, more puritanical life, and so on. So it's quite an attractive, although subtle, proposition. The Pakatan side, they have this traditional thing about, oh, we want to get rid of corruption, and thereby Malaysia should restructure drastically, and we could catch up with the modern world and so on. It's also very attractive to a lot of us who are in the urban area, but perhaps for those who are not attuned to that kind of fast-paced lifestyle in the urban area, the more puritanical, the more simpler lifestyle would appeal more to them. In Sabah and Sarawak, it's a whole different category because we are not even talking about simpler lifestyle. We are talking about lifestyle without electricity, without water, without roads, and so on.
Tong biru is still a joke.
Yeah,
in Sabah.
We are talking about basic livelihood, huh? To have enough to eat, to have clean water, to have medical treatments, and so on. So whoever comes along who could promise to alleviate their livelihood, most likely the voters will vote for him. And in Sabah's case, it turns out some of these are, shall we say, corrupt politicians. So that's why sometimes it makes you wonder. Some politicians are well known to be, well, shall we say, corrupt, but still they are voted time and again by their voters in Sabah and Sarawak. Well, because the voters have not much to look forward to. Huh? It's not like in Malaya, where you have, oh, I want to have a simpler lifestyle, or I want to have more hectic lifestyle. It's simply, I want to have a survival for me and my family. Yeah.
Okay. But despite all the changes and the events that are currently unfolding right before our eyes, one thing I'd like to note is that the communication and messaging by the political parties are now very refined. They are clearly hitting the right spots in terms of trying to entice their voter base, as you rightfully elucidated earlier. It's also important for us to note that the personality politics, at least in Semenanjung, has been reduced to some degree. However, it still persists in Sabah Sarawak, if I could recap your statements earlier. But it's also showing the maturity of our political conduct. We are seeing a lot of Malaysians now understanding the need for a coalition government to be formed, the need for a unity government to be formed. We need a government, unity or otherwise. And it seems like democracy is progressing in the right direction. That's where I view. Do you share this sentiment?
Well, in a sense, yeah, because we have a very fragmented political landscape, and therefore people would have to make compromises, political compromises, and this sort of political compromises eventually would lead us to a more mature political outlook. Already during this sort of political turbulence, we have pushed through, for example, the anti-hopping laws, Undi 18, well, with mixed consequence, but still it's an achievement.
It is an achievement.
Yeah.
It is an achievement. I mean, hands down. I would never have expected those between 18 to 20 and 21 to 29 to turn out at that record. I have had my skepticism. In fact, I'm just a skeptic all the way. But these kind of results have indeed proven that my skepticism is not well-founded. People do want to have a say in the ballot box. And then you say, oh, no, they voted wrongly. I said, no, that's not a fair statement to make. They voted the way their conscience told them to do so. If their parents told them to vote this way, so be it. They voted, they turned up. And because of this, the majority of the some of them, by the way, are now regretting their decisions. I've spent enough time talking to some of my family members. They were wondering why they voted for that way instead of the other. But I said, that is what you think, what Brexit people were not upset with their own referendum vote many years ago. But these are the consequences that you have to live with, right? And because of this, you expect better understanding of the political system and many more. Okay, final question, final topic. We've had you for 2 days now. I want to learn more about what you think on the role of the prime ministership, the premiership, and the man gunning it, Datuk Sri Anwar Ibrahim. He's already gotten that premiership role. He was talking at a long time now, talking about the separation of the role of the Prime Minister with other ministries. Lo and behold, he holds a finance ministry post. Perhaps one can easily argue the strongest post that anybody can have. Do you feel that it is in his interest to improve on the role of the Prime Minister? And in this light, do you feel that the role is going to be more draconian under his premiership? Or is he going to devalue it and try to bring down the power of the prime ministers the way he was arguing for the past 20, 30 years?
Well, I think the prime minister's department, for example, is too powerful. You have they would take upon themselves certain functions or other ministries and make it into a unit under the prime minister's department. I think some of these units, they could be sort of transformed into serving some of these cabinet clusters, which you mentioned before, like, for example, cabinet cluster for disaster management. I think there are several agencies under the prime minister's department, which are handling that. Could they be sort of transformed into supporting units for the cabinet clusters, for example? And then, in that sense, then you free up the prime minister to do more, shall we say, inspiring things, right? Yeah.
Not the day-to-day stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the prime minister should, just like Najib used to sit down with this Idris Jala to try to chart the, you know, the, how Malaysia can transform into a middle-income state, into a high-income state, and so on. Anwar must have the time to sit down together with Rafizi and perhaps a few others, not only to talk about party politics, but to really chart the course for this country as to, well, now we are not even talking about, well, we are talking about catching up only nowadays before we can talk about, you know, surpassing others. Yeah.
One item that we haven't touched is, of course, the civil service. We're talking about 1.6 million people. Anwar made the right, in fact, a fantastic move to get them involved in the first on his first day. After taking office on Saturday, on Monday, he immediately had the assembly and he just pulled everybody in. And he also made a very public call to all the politicians to start working collectively with the civil service, something that was not done in 2018 when Pakatan Harapan first got power. Where is their role in this place?
Well, we have undoubtedly a rather, shall we say, bloated civil service. If you look at the ratio of civil servants to our total population, we are one of the highest in the world. So, those you hire, you cannot just dismiss them without cause, right? But at least when you hire new ones, you can be more selective and perhaps hire not so many to stop it from keep on expanding. And the current civil servants, frankly speaking, there are quite a number who are underperforming. Is there some form of continuous education or training that you could provide for them, for example? But ultimately, we are talking about integrating this more than 1 million workers as to into the reform process, and they have to have the so-called buy-in. They must trust that this reform process is good for their family, for the country's future.
So man management is key, I suppose.
Yeah.
And HR, touch, personal, whatever, inspiring kind of role. Do you feel that the ministries have, or the ministers have that?
Well, some ministers have it more than others, right? I would love to work under somebody like Anthony, like Rafizi, like Nick Nasmi, like Fahmi and so on. Hopefully other ministers or Azalina, for
yeah.
example. Because these are really hardworking ministers. You know, they will be very demanding, I could imagine. But as civil servants, you learn a lot in the process and you have the sense of participation in trying to build this nation. Huh? That is much better than if you have a minister who is just there to cut ribbon, to open buildings and so on, right? So so that's why I say you must have the buy-in as to whether you believe that this country deserves to be better, and you as a civil servant would be part of that process.
What you're asking is a mindset shift. I don't think that's easy.
Well, I don't know what to say. I mean, this is a very hard-earned opportunity for us to make a change. The last 2 years during the pandemic, it's, you know, people lost hope, not only in terms of the pandemic, it was ongoing, but also because people thought of this country as being stagnant, I think. There was no new idea being put forward. It's only about, you know, the Prime Minister survives or not, which, of course, the Prime Minister still has to worry about that. But he has to inspire the people, civil servants, private citizens, and so on, that it is time for them to be more participatory in the building of this country.
What a great way to end. Participatory. That's the key word for this interview. If you've missed any part of this interview, just head on to astronomy.com. Look for Notepad, look for Pantau Kerajaan Baru, or look for Dr. O. Ehsan. He is a rather prominent speaker, not just in Astrawani, but across the country and internationally as well. Also, you can watch other resources that we have on all Astrawani digital platforms. My name is Ibrahim Sani. Catch you in the next one.